just starting the recording now. So last week I asked for some ideas about how to go forward with, you know, the stuff that we've covered over the last, I think about 8 weeks. And somewhere, Lori, I think it was you, came up with, you know, like, what do we do now? Which, you know, is an obvious thing. This is all great. This is wonderful. But what do we do now? And that application aspect, you know, is so crucial. And I'm really glad that came up as part of what we want to continue with. What also then came up, and Randy, thank you for this, and I'll circulate the article, is, well, what's the most challenging thing that we're all confronted with constantly? And how does what we've talked about over the last 8 weeks feed into this? And of course, the article, and I love the title, is from Harvard Business Review. And I'm a little, you know, I challenged Frank on this. I go, you know, you read this regularly. How come you didn't send this to me? And the article is called Difficult Conversations. And the title is How to Respectfully Discuss Contentious Issues. Now, it's focused primarily at work, but when I read the article, I thought, this is the entirety of our practice. And, you know, as one of you raised earlier, is, you know, mother issues, father issues, parental issues, how do we speak to them in a way that isn't fed by all of our childhood resentments, right? And all of our childhood struggles and all of our childhood desires to love them in ways that they could understand. Those are the two areas I think that are really important to kind of explore, is what is it about interactions that sometimes make it so difficult, not necessarily to speak online, but so difficult to be understood. We're all really good at speaking our minds. Maybe we shouldn't be quite so good sometimes. And maybe sometimes silence is a more noble conversation, you know, all of that, right? But what is it? What is it that keeps us, and this is something I've been struggling with since I read the articles, what is it that gets me in so much trouble when I'm trying to convey something that I think is going to be accepted because it's so obvious that it needs to be accepted? And maybe that's my mistake to begin with, is A, to think it's obvious, and B, to think it's going to be accepted. Because after all, you know, I'm logical, mindful, guru. Why wouldn't what I say be perfectly acceptable? So I guess the thing there is not just, it's humility. Part of it is humility, but the other part of it is, what's fueling how I present something so that it becomes a real challenge for the other person to be steady in the face of what I'm presenting? I can't take responsibility for their steadiness or lack of steadiness. But I do have to look at, what is it that I'm doing that's making the water very murky? And I know in my early days in doing my PhD, you know, you're so terrified, or I was so terrified of being thrown out. I was so terrified that I wouldn't fit. I don't think I was conscious of any of this, right? But I was so terrified about so many things, that I would be discovered to be stupid, or, you know, I really wasn't very bright at all. I've always had a fear that I'm not bright at all. That's, you know, that's kind of like my left arm, you know, it's always there. But it really impacted how I spoke to people and how I asked for things. And I never asked for things straight up. I never said, you know, I really need this. I'd have to come in like a scientific paper. First, you establish the history of the problem. Then you establish the need for further research. Then you propose a research procedure that you know is going to get you the answer that you need to the question that you're going to ask, but you haven't asked the question yet. And then you pose the key question that's going to summarize the entire history of the research that's been done before and how you're going to tackle it. But by the time I got to that part, people were so frustrated with me, I never got to the methodology, which of course then meant that the experiment was never run, or when it was run in such a murky way that the answer that we got just was not useful. And that was my entire set of relationships, not just in my, you know, with my professors, but with my family, with everybody. There had to be this logical sequence. And if someone stepped out of the sequence, I was completely derailed. I didn't know how to respond to it. Right? And in my head, I'm still up establishing the theory and the rationale for the need for this research. They're already at the methodology going, well, you should really do this. And that would completely throw me. So part of this article is really interesting, where it talks about the fear of being seen in certain ways, the fear of, and, you know, Randy, feel free to correct me if I'm not getting all of it in there, but it basically addresses the fear that I'm not going to be perceived a certain way. And if I'm not perceived a certain way, I'm going to be rejected. And in terms of a relationship, it's not just rejected. I'm going to lose the argument. Right. So we come back to that issue of the fear of rejection, the fear of not being heard, which is really a very profound fear. Because it cuts right to the bottom of, how do I feel safe in relationships? I'm only in control of a very small portion of feeling safe in a relationship. That was a real insight for me as I read the article. I thought, I don't have any control over being safe in relationships. Not as much as I would like to, but most of the time, I simply don't have any control of it. And I had to stop there and consider, how does that shape my approach to the relationship? Not just my attempts to manipulate it, right? But how does that shape my approach if I suddenly recognize, you know, at this stage and age, I recognize there's no way I can make myself feel safe in a relationship. There's no way someone else can guarantee my safeness in the relationship. And notice I use the word safeness, which is Paul Gilbert's word. And he talks about safeness as that felt sense of security that I won't be annihilated. Notice all these extremes, right? It's not just I won't be hurt, it's like I won't be annihilated, right? Because that's where the brain goes. That's where the woundedness goes. Right? So part of this is, how do I enter into discussions, even a simple discussion as, you know, do you want tea or coffee for breakfast? Do you want a poached egg or do you want French toast? You know, to notice what happens at those low threat conversations where suddenly, and there are some days where it's, you know, it is quite poignant at how challenging it is, but suddenly we feel like, oh, this feels like a life or death question. And it really isn't. So the first thing, I'm just going to, excuse me one moment. So how do we, first at this level, how do we begin to create that sense of safeness, right? In terms of our relationship? The first thing is, of course, to not assume that just because, I had this experience over the week where someone said, well, you know, I was talking about something that was really upsetting to me. And they said, well, you just need to ground yourself. You just need to ground yourself. And I'm like, okay, I'm glad this is a video call because I'm about to slug somebody. Don't tell me to ground myself. If I could, I would. The first step is to acknowledge that there's no magic to this. Grounding myself, taking a breath, doing the 3-minute breathing, all of which are really valuable. But the threat level has to be low enough that I can actually feel the effects of doing that. Right. So the first thing to do is to look at the relationship as I'm in it and to acknowledge, this is really scaring me. And sometimes it can be like, why is this scaring me? Because it's just a question of coffee or tea. But it can also be, oh, I'm seeing this person as having so much power over me. Just that acknowledgement in that moment. And it may be very real, and often it is. If it's an employer, if it's a colleague, if it's someone who has some level of decision-making skills, decision-making power that can negate what you're doing. So we have to acknowledge that right off the bat. We have to sit there and go, okay, listen, this is scaring me for some reason. And maybe that reason is very legitimate. It could have to do with many things. Later on, after the fact, we can deconstruct it to see what levels of the threat were not realistic. This person doesn't have life or death control over me. It would be very rare if someone you were talking to had life or death control over you, right? So part of that is to recognize, what is my projection in that moment to the future of, you know, if I don't do this the way this person is asking, then I'm likely to get in a conflict with them. Then I'm likely to get in a conflict with their superior person. Then I'm likely to be, you know, out of a job and homeless under the Rideau Street Bridge. That's a realistic set of thought patterns that do come up. But in that moment, it's not happening. In that moment, as I'm staying with the flow, I can hold also a little section of my mind that goes, we're not going to go there right now. We need to stay present to what's evolving. Because the article goes on to talk about a whole lot of other things. And one of the things that's really fascinating is one of the solutions that they propose, which I kind of went ouch at. I started going, ow, I do that constantly. Don't focus on convincing the other. It just brought to mind getting into a boxing ring, and immediately it's like, okay, I got to beat my perspective into you. Right? And I'll do it with every intellectual power I have. Obviously, apparently, it's not the best approach. The idea of allowing the energy of the discussion to grow can sometimes be very scary. And one of the concepts that I really enjoy working with is Wu Wei. It's that process of flow, ebb and flow of an interaction, of a stream, right? The ebb and flow of it. And keeping our balance within that, right? If the water is moving a certain way, we move with it. As it shifts, we shift with it, right? So keeping that constant balance of imbalance. But when I want to convince somebody of something, I get very rigid, right? I get stuck in needing to be the one who wins. I sometimes feel like I should tattoo that on my forearm. You do not have to be the one who wins. So now I've got a short form reminder, mindfulness bell that says, and it starts with, are you trying to be the one who, and I fill in the blank. And it surfaces the competitiveness in all of us, right? It can even be a statement like, are you trying to be seen as the one who resolves the conflict, is able to work with the most difficult person in the room, is, right? Coming back to parents, you know, with my brother and I, it was always, and I'm looking back and realizing, it was always a case of, could I be the one who's loved more? That constant competition, and not in a sense, it's a duel to the death, right? I have to show that I'm, and sometimes I'm not, because I'm trying to be the one who. Right? So this concept, the first point that they talk about in this article is, don't focus on convincing. And I just want to read this little section here. It says, used by 48% of the respondents, they did a study of strategies that people use. Used by 48% of respondents, don't let your main goal be to change the other person's mind. Instead, encourage the sharing of ideas and listening before responding. So I just want to stay at that point of, what happens when my main goal is to change the other person's mind? You think about it. How good are we at changing our own minds? I have yet to change my mind about Brussels sprouts. I think I'm getting there because I figured out how to air fry them. But I can't change my mind about the fact that I hate Brussels sprouts. If I can't do that with something as innocuous as Brussels sprouts, what gives me the arrogance of self, the conceit, that I can actually change someone else's mind? Now, I'm sure there are times when I do, but that's probably because I inadvertently get into sharing and listening. You know, I don't mean to be empathetic, but damn it, here I was being empathetic. Which I suppose is hopeful. It means if I actually practiced it, I might get better at it. So start there. Start with that humility. You know, start with that humanness of, I can barely change my own mind about things I'm so fixed about. What makes me think that I can, by force of will, change? So here's the challenge. And it is scary. I know, I feel it even as I talk about it. What happens if I take a deep breath and step back and ask them what they think? Be curious. Just as I'm curious when I'm sitting in meditation, this is a great bridge from sitting practice to relationship. What if I become curious about their thought patterns in the same way I'm curious about mine when they arrive? What if I become a larger vessel for this? You know, when we do the goblet exercise, right, we bring out this whole, the entire experience. What if I include their thoughts in that experience while I'm still grounded in my breath and my seat or my feet or wherever I am? What might happen? My favorite practice. What might happen if I let go of needing to be the one with the solution? Or needing to be the one who's heard? I like that one. What might happen? Who is understood? Who is accepted? So there's our practice for this week, is to continuously ask that question. What might happen if I let go of needing to be the one who? You can fill in the blank.